Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on Google Play, on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere where they have podcasts. And once again, a big thank you to all of our listeners. We're on track to have a record month in March, which I'm glad. I don't fully understand, given the fact that podcast listenership apparently is down during the pandemic, but that doesn't apply to us. So we'll try to keep the streak going. And we are joined today by our good friend Daniel Dresner, who's a professor at the Fletcher School, a contributor to the Washington Post, and the author of the new book, The Toddler in Chief: What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency. I'm sorry. I'm laughing.
I'm so glad you couldn't get through the title without laughing. That's
no. I'm looking at the cover, and the cover is the big baby Trump balloon.
Yes, it is with a black cover. The University of Chicago Press published it. They did a brilliant job with the cover. I'm over the moon about it.
Well, the thing that people who listen might be familiar with your tweets about whether or not the president is the toddler in chief, and you marked yesterday was the 1,364th tweet in the thread of you'll take Donald Trump seriously when his staff stops treating him like a toddler.
Right. So this actually, it celebrated its third birthday on this Saturday, on April 25th. So the threat is now officially more mature than the president of the United States in terms of biological age.
I've never heard of a threat having a birthday before.
They're not normally this long. And by the way, one of the awful things about it is that Twitter's functionality on this thread is awful. If you go to the first tweet, trying to find the next couple of follow-up tweets is actually relatively hard, depending upon what interface you use. Although you can go backwards now. But it's and I have to stress, when I wrote that first tweet, I did not think, oh yeah, I'm totally going to be doing this 3 years from now. You've been on Twitter. I was on Twitter as well. It was a snarky response to, if you recall, there was this aching desire, in the first couple months of the Trump administration to normalize Trump, to believe that essentially Donald Trump would grow into the presidency, that yes, he had handled the campaign in an immature fashion, the transition was not great, but that there were adults in the room, or that he would recognize the majesty of the office. And so whenever there was even a slight feint towards maturity, his first joint address to Congress, or when he explained the Syria missile strikes, you had people like Fareed Zakaria or Van Jones going on television saying this was the day Donald Trump became president. And, the problem was that if you read any of the press coverage, you knew that was not the case. And furthermore, all of the to get added to the thread, it's not someone like Nancy Pelosi or someone like Michelle Goldberg criticizing the president like he's a toddler. It is someone who has a rooting interest in Donald Trump's political success, nonetheless describing him the way you would describe a petulant 2-year-old. So I wrote that first tweet saying, I'll believe that Trump is growing into the presidency when his staff stops talking about him like a toddler. It was in response to a Washington Post story. And I didn't really even think anything more of it. I thought it would have the half-life of a tweet. And then a couple days later, I saw a couple stories in Politico where it seemed like the same kind of thing. So I thought, okay, I guess I should thread this. Maybe there's a theme here. And we're 3 years, 1,360 plus tweets later.
So there are competing narratives about Donald Trump. I mean, we'll leave aside for the moment that, he is the great leader who is going to restore America's pride in itself, the man on the white horse who alone can solve all of our problems. We'll just leave that aside, that sort of thing. There are others who think that, including, like George Conway, that he's got some serious mental unwellness. There are others who say that, toddlers are harmless. He is not harmless. He is an authoritarian. He's a wannabe Mussolini. So in terms of all of that continuum, you fall on the toddler. So just put it in comparison, because toddlers aren't scary. Toddlers aren't authoritarians, and toddlers are not necessarily mentally deranged, right? They're just immature, petulant narcissists.
Right. I was going to say, now this is where I occasionally, and I do say this explicitly in the book, I'm not trying to demean toddlers. when I compare Trump to them, because toddlers behave the way they do for really, really good reasons, which is they lack the cognitive capacities and you know, ability to emotionally self-regulate. And so when they have a temper tantrum or, you know, if they have poor impulse control, that's because biologically that's how they're hardwired. Trump is obviously biologically not a toddler. But what was striking to me as I was doing the thread and then as I decided to write the book is that I understand the argument that he suffers from narcissistic personality disorder or that he's more like a teenager. Or that maybe he's suffering from cognitive decline. You know, Joe Scarborough has made that argument as well. And, it, you know, to use the language of scholarship, I look forward to future scholarly debates on this. You know, the future literature can really tackle this. But I do think the toddler analogy works for a couple of reasons. The first is, for lack of a way of putting it, it is something we all intuitively get in a way that saying narcissistic personality disorder and explaining the sort of psychological traits, you know, will cause people occasionally to glaze over. And also it does avoid the rather awkward issue of, do you really want to diagnose? I didn't want to play amateur psychiatrist on this. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to say he clearly suffers from psychiatric, you know, psychiatric disorder, even though I am not a psychiatrist and I have never met him. On the other hand, when his staffers start talking about him the way you would talk about your two-year-old who has skipped a nap, that's something we all can understand. We can all relate to that. And so I thought that the analogy there worked in a better way to understand why Trump does what he does. And then, you know, the other thing is, I think the reason I felt more confident talking about him like a toddler is I've been a parent. I've raised two toddlers. And you're right, toddlers are not autocratic. But if we can be honest for a little bit, we've all had moments when our toddlers have not behaved well. And, you know, we've been incredibly frustrated. So it is possible that I was working through some issues in terms of parenting and in terms of writing this, you know, exercising some demons. And of course, the amusing element about this is that, the book opens, each of the chapters in the book opens with a quote from the American Academy of Pediatrics, caring for your young child, the manual. And there are a number of ironies about this, the most important being that my wife, when she saw me reading the book, immediately responded with, "Now you're reading this book?" Because I did not read it when I had young children, whereas she, you know, obviously had. But for research, apparently I could be motivated to read these kinds of books. And as I read it, I realized that it really did work as a comparison because, and furthermore, the book describes, you know, your young child from infancy to about 5 years old. And I realized reading it, the chapter that best fit Trump wasn't the chapter on 5-year-olds or 4-year-olds or 3-year-olds. It was about 2-year-olds. It was toddlers.
Oof. So I'm reading from the review in the Washington Post where you're saying that you don't simply argue that Trump is ill-suited for the presidency. You argue that Trump is incapable of adult behavior. We knew most of these things about Trump before Dresner published his book, but he presents a smothering avalanche of repeated presidential absurdity. The reader realizes that this pattern is not a part of the Trump presidency. It is the whole thing. So the avalanche, part of the problem, of course, with the Trump era is there's so much that you forget it.
That was one of the reasons why I wrote this, actually, because we talk about the memory hole issue.
Yes.
Of, you know, just stories that in a other presidency would have had, you know, a week or 2 weeks in which we would have perseverated on it. Whereas, you know, in nowadays you forget it less than 24 hours later or something. And so one of the virtues of the thread actually for me is that it reminded me when I was writing the book of, oh, right, he did that. I forgot that, you know, like during the transition, he got a call from the president of Egypt and he said, oh, Egypt, you know, have you heard of that Bangles song, Walk Like an Egyptian?
No, you know, that did not happen.
That did happen. Michael Lewis, you know, unless you're calling Michael Lewis a liar because he reported it. He absolutely did that. You know, the fact that Trump, you know, tried to buy Greenland thinking that this would be a possible idea.
Or the Sharpie on the weather map.
The Sharpie on the weather map. That is actually, I think that is my favorite example because it is simultaneously Trump, it was an innocent mistake by Trump. Yeah, like he's, for once, he's, it's not malice aforethought. He probably said Alabama, he screwed up. The National Weather Service corrected him quickly because that does matter to the residents of Alabama. And then everything after that was just pure theater because he refused to admit that he'd made a mistake. And as a result, you know, what would should have been a, all he had to do was issue a correction and an apology, and that would have been it. Instead, we had a week worth of stories about this, including the Sharpie, including, I believe, two internal investigations of political interference in the bureaucracy. So, you know, part of the reason I wrote this was to remind everyone, yeah, he's done all these things.
So put this in context of what we've seen in the last week, because the strength of the Twitter thread is it can be constantly updated. It has to be constantly updated. But last week, the whole injection of disinfectants and then the claim, which in some ways is actually kind of neater. When he says, no, I was just being sarcastic. After all of the usual suspects in the conservative media came out and explained that, no, he didn't really say it. He never said that. Well,
he did
say actually made perfect sense because he's got this great brain. And then he, of course, does what he always does. He cuts them off at the knees by saying, but I was being sarcastic, which, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's, maybe Hugh Hewitt believed that, but I don't know that anybody else in the world did. There's my cheap shot at Hugh Hewitt, but I was being sarcastic. I mean, that is kind of the, you really are a case of arrested development here.
Yes. I think this last episode highlights two elements of the way that Trump deals with this and his staff deals with this that are interesting. The first is that Trump never sticks to one excuse. He just throws everything at the wall and we'll see what he sticks. Anytime he has gotten into serious trouble, you know, think the Helsinki press conference with Putin, or the Ukraine fiasco, or, you know, this, he will simultaneously basically try every excuse in the book of, I didn't really say that. I was joking. No, I totally meant it. What's the problem with that? You know, and so it winds up, I think, frustrating his supporters and his political allies, because the danger, if you're a political ally, of trying to defend Donald Trump when he steps into it is that you're never entirely sure what Trump himself is going to do in response. And so God forbid you actually get too far out in front of what Trump is going to do, and then you wind up looking like an idiot. The other thing that I did think was interesting about this past week, though, is that one of the things I was concerned about as the toddler-in-chief threat has evolved is that, you know, Trump has purged his staff repeatedly. The burn rate of Trump's White House staff and his cabinet is much higher than it was in the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration. And part of this, to be fair to Trump, was there were people who clearly were speaking ill of him in the press. And, you know, any president does not like having to deal with leakers or people who are perceived as disloyal. And therefore, he wanted a more loyal staff and a more loyal cabinet. And my concern was that as this happened, there would be fewer staffers who would be willing to speak to the press in more candid ways, talking about, you know, yeah, he just lost his control today, or, you know, yeah, he just acted on impulse or what have you. What was fascinating to me was in the 24 hours after that injection comment, there were stories in five separate media outlets from, you know, all sourced to White House staffers saying, yeah, this was a screw up. He just, you know, we got to get him off the stage. He just, you know, vamps for 2 hours. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's not being properly briefed and so on and so forth. And so this is after 3 years of ostensibly putting together a more loyal team. There are still people who simultaneously served the Trump administration and are clearly appalled at his behavior.
You know, it did strike me, and I think I probably said this on the podcast, that one of the interesting aspects of these, you know, nationally televised monologues is that we're seeing Donald Trump, the Donald Trump that people saw 3 years ago in the Oval Office, you know, just sort of freelancing and free associating and coming up with absolutely crazy ideas. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, somebody was able to divert his attention, give him a shiny object or whatever, or, you know, and that, because I was thinking that watching that James Mattis is sitting at home going, you know, man, we went through that over and over and over again. We're seeing it in real time. Okay, so you break the book down into 8 chapters. Temper tantrums, short attention span, poor impulse control, oppositional behavior, knowledge deficits, only one chapter, too much screen time, and then you have a potpourri or a toddler sampler. So, and then the final one is when caregivers give up staffing the toddler in chief. So let's, can we just walk through some of the, give me temper tantrums. That's a toddler thing, right?
And it's completely a toddler thing. I mean, it's easily the trait that Trump displays the most. He has limited control over his anger. It's the tendency that gets repeated over and over again. And indeed, we've seen it on display during the response to the coronavirus in ways that have clearly hampered the administration's response. The most obvious one being his he was infuriated by a CDC official, Nancy Messonnier, saying in late February, yeah, we've got community spread in the United States. The pandemic is going to hit here. And if you remember, markets didn't react terribly well to that, even though it was the truth. And Trump, coming back from a state visit to India, immediately gets on the phone, chews out Alex Azar. And we have not heard really from Nancy Messonnier since then. And it clearly deterred the coronavirus task force's attempt to brief Trump on the idea of we need to take more serious lockdown steps now. Trump loses his temper on a fairly regular basis, and his ability to emotionally regulate his anger is difficult. And in the current moment, it's exacerbated by the fact that, and in some ways, this also explains, I think, the press conferences, is that Trump's normal ability to, you know, expend energy or find a diversion no longer exists. He can't go out and play golf. He can't go to Mar-a-Lago. He can't go to, is it Bedminster? Is that his other golf club?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. He can't go to Bedminster. You know, he can't see really that many other people. So all he can do is watch television, see negative coverage of him, and then lash out.
Mm. But see, now toddlers aren't vindictive. They're not vicious. Right. I mean, here you have somebody who is, I mean, there's a certain maliciousness about him, the desire to destroy and to demean. Yeah, he engages in, you know, juvenile name calling. But, you know, I'm trying to defend the toddlers here. You know, toddlers generally don't, you know, plot their revenge.
No, toddlers certainly don't plot their revenge. But toddlers do lash out. Toddlers get into, you know, fights. Toddlers will occasionally, you know, will hit each other if they're both going for the same toy or so on and so forth. And not all toddlers will do this. I can't tell you the number of times I've had someone respond to me on Twitter saying, well, my child never behaves like this. And, you know, my response is you're not looking at your child 24/7. First of all, but second, it's a fair point that you're right. Trump doesn't, you know, Trump obviously, has longer term senses. Trump has more sense of grievance than most toddlers do, or toddlers immediately act out on their grievance. Whereas with Trump, it just stays. He doesn't just act out immediately. It persists time and time again.
Well, and of course, the vocabulary is so simple. I mean, Donald Trump, I feel like Donald Trump is always like, 30 seconds away from calling somebody poopy head. Right? I mean, it's just.
No, I can totally see him saying, you're a poop head.
Yeah.
And again, that's, you know, that's the, it's the thing when you watch him, obviously.
Okay. Short attention span.
Yeah. This is another big problem, obviously, which is that I had a, I know someone who interviewed for a potential cabinet or sub-cabinet position for Trump during the transition. And so as a result, had an hour long meeting with him. And this person told me later that it wasn't really a one-hour meeting. It was actually 61-minute meetings, because essentially what Trump was doing was sort of asking questions that were unconnected to each other and would get bored after a minute. So it'd be things like, you know, what do you think of NATO? You know, should we sign a treaty with Mexico? How expensive is a fighter? How many satellites do we have in space? You know, and the questions sort of ping pong, from one to another. And this has been a clear problem also in terms of the staff's ability to brief Trump. I think the best example of this is a complaint that Gary Cohn lodged that was, in Bob Woodward's book, where he said, there's no point to briefing him, in an hour, because if you try it after 10 minutes, he'll get distracted. He will bring in, you know, some extraneous point, and then you've lost the plot. You can't do it. And indeed, this has also, by the way, been very clear in terms of his handling of the coronavirus, where, I think there was a one of the more recent additions to the thread is that Trump will occasionally show up to the actual coronavirus task force meetings. He doesn't do it all that often, but when he does, he derails the entire conversation because it ceases to be about the pandemic or even about the pandemic response, but rather how the media is treating him.
Well, and also we just heard, you know, Washington Post has a story either today or yesterday pointing out that, that this was in his briefing books. The warnings were in the briefing books. But as we know, Donald Trump doesn't read the briefing book. I mean, if the deep state
was
really
in the PDB, exactly. Yeah, it was. It was in the presidential daily brief. Yeah. And he's never read it. I mean, that's been a consistent through line that he prefers oral briefings. And to be fair, some presidents always, you know,
pictures
will prefer that.
He needs pictures. He doesn't want books. He wants big pictures.
Well,
the toddler thing.
Yeah, the other thing I recall one of the stories in the book is that a lot of the times the intelligence briefers were told put Trump's name in the briefing because he will then look for his name, and that's a way you can, you know, capture his attention and so forth.
Okay, poor impulse control.
Yeah, I think even Trump supporters will acknowledge that that he demonstrates poor impulse control. For Trump, he sees this as it's not a flaw. This is the design. Trump disdains any kind of significant planning. He believes that he is best when he acts on a gut impulse. And I will say, by the way, this is one of the areas where, you know, if you want to explain why Donald Trump succeeded, for example, in 2016, I do think that one of the reasons he succeeded on the debates in particular is that, in contrast to most of the other people on the stage, you could tell Trump was actually in the moment. He didn't have anything planned, so he would actually, you know, sort of vamp. And it's very different hearing that as opposed to, let's say, Marco Rubio's kind of canned responses. And so there's a way in which that has an effect. But the other problem is that Trump keeps implementing policy by impulse. And indeed, that combined with Twitter is a disastrous combination because he will have an idea rather than talk to his staff or, you know, get some feedback or have a vetting process. He just tweets it out.
This is important because every once in a while there'll be an adult moment where somebody gives him a piece of paper or a speech to read and people go, okay, well, this is the new tone, you know, and you know that the staff is telling him, okay, now don't do this. Don't say this. Don't just, don't, and he's going to do it. You just know he's going to do it. He's going to blurt it out. It's like, it must be, you know, that must be one of the recurring toddler management problems of the staff. Everybody's saying,
in fact,
how can we keep the president from saying this and knowing that it's just gonna, can't help himself?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I think Gary Cohn actually said at one point that he did not tell, you know, every month there's the employment numbers. And that's obviously something that, you know, when the economy was good, Trump liked to brag about. And the truth is that the president usually gets those numbers about 24 hours before they're made public. But of course, you are not, as the president, supposed to talk about them. And I think Gary Cohn said in an interview at one point that he decided early on he would not give Trump the information before it was made public because he couldn't trust Trump to not make it public. And at one point after Cohn left, Trump was given the numbers and did blurt out something that indicated he knew the numbers were going to be good. And even the White House acknowledged, yeah, he screwed up during that moment. And then there were other instances where I think Joe Hagan, who was a deputy chief of staff, who was trying to set up, among other things, the Trump-Kim summit and so on and so forth, basically would not tell the president in advance, like, key, like, timing and dates of key meetings until it was locked down because he knew that Trump would tweet it out.
Knowledge deficits. I mean, where do we start on this one? So
I thought this was a nice way of phrasing it. And also, by the way, this is one of the strongest arguments I can make about why Trump is different, why the toddler analogy works as opposed to the teenager or the doddering old man, which is, you know, say what you will about teenagers and old people, they too tend to know some things. And also they have metacognition. They know what they don't know very often. Toddlers, you know, for all of their virtues, obviously don't know a great deal about the world. And so they need to be taught and they need to be tutored. And this speaks to Trump's, you know, Trump is unique when he was elected president. He was the first president who had no military or government background. It showed. And, you know, name your story in which Trump has demonstrated tremendous amounts of ignorance. I guess with the coronavirus pandemic, clearly the fact that he's thinking, oh, well, what if we inject disinfectant? But actually, even before that, I think there was a briefing in February or early March where Trump basically asked doctors, well, wait a minute, can't you just use the flu vaccine? Can't you create like a super vaccine from the flu and use it to stop the coronavirus? And of course, these are two different things. And basically all the doctors immediately said, no, you can't do that. And so one of the things that's remarkable is watching Trump in real time trying to understand issues that, you know, most politicians either have actually bothered to do the work and try to bone up on, or at least recognize that they don't know and are willing to defer to experts. And he can't do either of these things. Trump is simultaneously the most ignorant president and the one who is loudly and proudly confident of his expertise.
Yeah, and that's the distinctive part about Donald Trump. I mean, how many times does he point to his head and says, well, I don't need any information because it's all here. Do you know I have a very, very big brain? I have a great brain. My uncle was a genius. I have a degree from Wharton. He has this supreme confidence, but also just the profundity of the ignorance of what he's ignorant of.
Right. And the other thing is that with, you know, anyone who has watched Trump for any extended period of time, or even a brief period of time, it becomes very easy and very visible very quickly when he doesn't know what he's talking about, or when he has just gotten a fact and just learned it, because he will then repeat that fact to everyone like he discovered it, you know. But then when he's asked about something that it's clear he has no idea what's going on, he'll say, we'll see what happens. Or we're working on it. Or, I mean, he doesn't even have a great variety of stock phrases, but it is clear when, as a professor, I can't tell you the number of times you look at Donald Trump and you think, oh man, that boy hasn't done his homework.
We've all written that. Yeah, we've all done this, right? Or we've always seen this. You do the book report and you haven't read the book, but you got to kind of fake it. But he doesn't think that anybody ever sees through that. Okay, so
right, and that's the toddler element, by the way, because toddlers also are convinced, you know, when they do have to make up stuff, that they are pulling it off. You know, the number of times you catch your kid stealing a cookie, and he's looking at you like, you didn't see me. There's no way you could have seen me. No, I didn't take the cookie. You know, and that's what they share with Trump.
Okay, so too much screen time. I think we know where this is going.
Yes. So to be fair, this isn't so much a trait as a something that parents are presumably not supposed to allow their children to do. But, you know, with Trump, he does nothing but watch television. My favorite example of this most recently is I don't know if you saw this New York Post story that came out yesterday where the argument was he really does work very hard.
So hard. Time to eat.
Yes, exactly. But nonetheless, you know, and one of the justifications for how hard he's working is that he watches TV like a linebacker watches football tape, which is truly an inspired justification. But yeah, I mean, clearly he watches television 24/7. He watches very little but cable news, and indeed he reacts to the news, it sort of combines with the poor impulse control. My favorite example of this from the book is, I think, at one point he had Lindsey Graham in the Oval Office, and they were talking about Kim Jong-un. This was in the days when he was, you know, doing fire and fury sort of rhetoric. And apparently, you know, of course, a television was on, because the television is always on if you're with Donald Trump. And apparently the television showed like a missile launch or something from North Korea.
Oh, yeah.
And Trump looked at the footage and thought, wait, is this happening in real time? Oh, my God. He's like starting to get really exercised. And Lindsey Graham, of all people, is the one who has to tell him, no, this is just B-roll. This is not happening right now. It's OK. You know, when Lindsey Graham is the calming force in response to North Korea, you know that things are off the rails.
OK, so this raises the question. You're Lindsey Graham. You've been around statesmen before. You used to be John McCain's friend. You're seeing the president of the United States, who clearly is a toddler. And yet, rather than, you know, walking out of that room going, oh, my God, what are we going to do about this? This is just terrible. He decides that he's going to become his best friend. Is this an appeal for guys like Lindsey Graham that because he's a toddler, do they think that he needs me so much, or he needs me and I can manipulate him? What's the interaction of United States senators understanding that the man who controls the largest nuclear arsenal in the world basically has the emotional makeup of a toddler.
So there are a couple things going on. The first is that I should add, Lindsey Graham gives the best toddler quote in the entire book, and it was on the record. It's when he says, the president's been, he can be a handful. That's just the way it is. and God bless Senator Graham for that. I think there are two things going on. In some ways, this gets to the deeper argument in the book. The first is, as you say, when you encounter a leader who clearly is radically uninformed and seems to have the emotional makeup of a toddler, I'm sure every politician or staffer thinks, I can use this to my advantage. I can be the Svengali. I can be the one who shapes or guides what he should do. If I can be the Trump whisperer, then I can actually execute real change that I want in terms of public policy. And so there are people like Stephen Miller or Lindsey Graham who I'm sure believe that's true. But I do think there's something else, and this is, you know, in some ways the more dangerous part about this, and this is the other argument I make in the book, that it's not just that Donald Trump is a toddler. It's that this is a bigger problem now than it would have been 50 years ago. And the reason is because all of the guardrails and checks and balances on the president have worn down to a nub. Now, some of this is because of congressional dysfunction, excessive judicial deference. It's because presidents long before Trump learned how to expand the power of the presidency over the bureaucracy, over independent agencies and what have you. But another factor is that Donald Trump is incredibly popular with the Republican Party base. You know, he does have close to 90% approval among Republicans. And so as a result, if you are a Republican, you cannot cross Donald Trump and continue to have a political future. This explains why the people who did speak up against Trump in his first couple of years, think Bob Corker or Mark Sanford or Jeff Flake, are no longer in office. The one Republican who in the end decided that Trump was unfit for office in the House of Representatives, Justin Amash, is now an independent. And so people like Graham recognize, and we're seeing this play out in this election cycle, where even people like Susan Collins or Cory Gardner, who are clearly in very tough races and don't have a great chance of winning, also know that nonetheless they don't profit from crossing Trump. Because even if they do so as a way to sort of appeal to moderate voters, what they then do is alienate the GOP base, and they have no chance of winning unless they have rock solid Republican support. And so the party is stuck with Trump because there are very few elected officials that have the ability to push back on Trump and nonetheless live to see another day. It's telling that I think the elected official that's been the most outspoken in the last few years, who's Mitt Romney, just got elected in 2018 and has four more years. And also, I think, doesn't care if he doesn't get reelected, which is the other attitude you have to have. And the problem is that there aren't that many Republicans with that attitude.
So chapter 8, when caregivers give up staffing the toddler in chief, and you start every chapter with something from the American Academy of Pediatrics, caring for your baby and young child. So your quote at the beginning of when caregivers give up, without strong guidance, a very active child's energy can easily turn toward aggressive or destructive behavior. To avoid this, you need to establish clear and logical rules and enforce them consistently. Yeah, how'd that work?
Yeah. Well, and to be fair to the staffers, the ones that actually did go to work for it. I mean, first of all, you know, when the Republicans sent staffers to the Trump administration, they didn't send their best. There were a lot of Republicans who sat on the sidelines for a variety of reasons, namely dealing with Donald Trump. But even the ones who went into work for him, you know, the analogy I make in the book, and I think this is appropriate, is, you know, the White House is like a poorly paid, poorly run daycare center. You know, we've all had childcare facilities where if the daycare workers are poorly paid, they're going to cycle through very quickly because it's an unrewarding job in many instances, and the pay is not worth it. You would think that being a White House staffer, which is paid a little bit better and presumably gets afforded more prestige, would lead to more attractive workers. But that actually hasn't happened in this instance. First of all, because in many instances, the people who leave the White House aren't getting the jobs they were expecting. But the other problem is that in contrast to a daycare center, the problem you have to deal with when you're working at the White House is that the toddler also has the constitutional powers of the presidency. Mm-hmm. So unlike, you know, a parent or another authority figure, you know, who can eventually get toddlers to realize they're in trouble, it's much harder to do when the person you're dealing with is the president of the United States. And so as a result, it's a thankless task. And you know, we've seen him cycle through four chief of staff, four national security advisors. Are we on the seventh press spokesman or communications? I've lost track.
I've totally lost track.
And the other problem, of course, is that as he cycled through, even people that might be somewhat sympathetic to Trump no longer want to work for him because obviously they've seen the horror show. It doesn't look like it's terribly fun. And I have to admit, my favorite story this past month has been the stories that have come out about Mark Meadows now taking on the White House chief of staff. Mark Meadows, who had dealt with Trump for 3 years, who was apparently nonetheless shocked at what being the White House chief of staff to Trump is like.
If only someone had warned him.
You would think he would have figured this out already, but like clearly based on the press reporting, he is shell shocked about what he is dealing with. And so the problem is you wind up having people who are just pure sycophants. Stephanie Grisham, I think, is my favorite example of this because back in the fall, John Kelly was, you know, giving a talk and basically was talking about impeachment. And Kelly apparently said that he warned Trump as he was leaving, you need a strong chief of staff because unless you have one, you will do something that will get you impeached. You know, which admittedly is self-serving by Kelly, given that he's left, but nonetheless, you know, sounds relatively accurate. Grisham then issued a press release or a statement, and I love this, saying, I served with John Kelly, and John Kelly could not appreciate Donald Trump's brilliance. Which, you know, that's Kim Jong-un level, propaganda. And so, you know, the result is that it's not just the staff is eroded in quality. The staff has basically given up coping with him. And that's the other thing that comes through in the quotes is that it's clear that despite efforts to keep Trump focused, and the GOP rhetoric on this has shifted over time, that in his first year when Trump would misbehave, you'd have members of his staff or members of Congress say, you know, he's new to the job.
Right.
He's not a normal politician. He's going to figure out this out. Now what you hear from these same people is not that. It's that this is what the presidency is now. He's a disruptor. You know, he's a unique leadership style. And this is what we need, which is obviously questionable. But it shows that they've actually surrendered the argument.
So speaking of his staff now, Deborah Birx, I had a reporter who called me and was asking about Deborah Birx's performance over the weekend where she's trying to defend the president, running a little bit of cover for him. And I guess I'm somewhat sympathetic because in your thesis, her job right now is managing the toddler. And so she has this very thin line to walk that if she knows that she needs to be give him the fulsome praise, she needs to be sycophantic in order to be at the table. And you know, let's face it, you know, everybody right now is walking a tightrope, right? If you want to have influence, you have to, you know, do this sort of North Korean praise. So am I too sympathetic to her?
I don't think I actually kind of feel in a similar way, which is I've blown hot and cold on Deborah Birx, but you know, because there have been times where she said things where you're like, really, that seems a bit over the top, where she talks about the president's ability to absorb information or so on and so forth. And I'm like, that doesn't jibe with any other coverage of Trump. But that said, and in some ways this gets to a larger issue of, is it possible to honorably serve in this administration? You know, I know that, you know, as someone who ordinarily studies foreign policy, this is something that a lot of foreign policy people in the GOP wrestled with of, is it better to stay in and prevent something really bad from happening? If you recall, like after the Charlottesville comments in 2017, there was a great Axios story that quoted a lot of anonymous staffers, but basically said, why are these people not quitting en masse? Why are they still working? And the one of the responses was, you have no idea the stuff we stop from happening. If we leave, it will get much, much worse. And it's always one of those things where it sounds like an easy justification or rationalization.
It seems plausible, though.
Yeah. In their defense, though, I think if you look at after that, you know, the crew of like Gary Cohn or John Kelly or so on and so forth, all these people left, it did get worse. And so, you know, we are in the middle of a very serious pandemic. And if Deborah Birx needs to occasionally assuage Trump's ego on television in order to maintain what is clearly her, you know, ability to actually do good policy work, I'm not going to begrudge her that. And I do wonder, there's part of me that wonders if there is a little bit of good cop, bad cop going on between her and Fauci. I have no idea if this is just speculation, but I mean, obviously Fauci has gotten out over his skis in terms of some of the comments he's made in interviews. And indeed that Fauci's comments have gotten added to the toddler in chief threat. And I wonder if, you know, Fauci and Birx agreed that essentially if Birx is a better Trump whisperer, then she shouldn't expend that capital by occasionally, you know, saying anything wrong. And let's face it, the other thing is that sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. And so the most devastating ad I've seen against Donald Trump in the last 2 weeks was that ad that just showed a slower close-up of Deborah Birx as Trump's talking about the sunlight and injecting disinfectant and so on and so forth. And, you know, I'm looking at that and like, that is every mother dealing with a toddler acting out. You can see her like deep breaths, looking down, not overreacting, not yelling, you know, only would that all parents demonstrate that kind of maturity.
Okay. So what I really love about your book in particular is the whole, and by the way, people need to just look at the cover here that, you know, the toddler in chief as the balloon baby, to contrast it with this image that some people in Trump world have, that he's a man's man, that support of Trump is really a test of your manhood. And I did a piece yesterday for The Bulwark about, you know, Seb Gorka talking about, you know, this is a lesson in masculinity, and you people on the left, you never Trumpers, you know, you're not manly enough to realize what a manly man Donald Trump is. And I'm looking at him going, okay, I have certain images of manhood and, you know, stereotypes of it. He fits none of them. And yet somehow people can look at this man child and think this is the avatar of masculinity. How do you explain that?
I think it's not so much the avatar of masculinity. I think the one thing I didn't put in the book after I finished it and thought about it more, realized I should have put in was, I do think I understand a little bit Trump's appeal to his base in that, because he acts like a toddler, because they are confusing masculinity with immaturity, basically, which is what they are seeing is a president that acts without constraint. You know, he lashes out constantly. He is willing to say what other people won't say. He's rude and he's crude and so forth. And I think to a certain slice of the United States, of Americans, that is liberating, because being an adult is hard. You know, being an adult, you have to be nice. You have to learn manners. You have to take other people's feelings into account. You know, even empathetic humans occasionally get sick of this after a while. And I think for some of Trump's base, there is something liberating watching him act in a completely unconstrained manner. The story that I in the book that and the one where I knew I had a book was this was in the middle of 2017. It was a Time magazine cover story where it was revealed that when Trump has dinner with people at the White House and dessert is served, other people get one scoop of ice cream, and Trump gets two scoops of ice cream plus chocolate sauce. And like, that's the ultimate toddler power play, right? You know, if you it's simultaneously very, you know, immature. But who among us has not thought, yeah, that would be kind of cool to pull, you know? So, and I think that's partially what's going on. I think people look at Trump acting in this unconstrained manner and think that's the masculinity. Masculinity is defined as not conforming to rules or norms of behavior. And it's a contrast to the sort of traditional, there is obviously another way of thinking about masculinity, codes of chivalry, codes of honor, and so on and so forth. But Trump doesn't display any of those. For Trump, it's all about he can do whatever he wants. And I think that's appealing to a certain slice of the electorate that, you know, in some ways finds him acting out.
Yeah. And this is another way in which he changes us. You know, I've made the point in the past that he is what he is. I mean, he's living his dream. I mean, you know, he's a billionaire. Yeah. He's president of the United States. He flies around in Air Force One. He's married to his supermodel. So we've sort of got him. But then you turn around and go, okay, but what is he doing to the rest of us? So the toddler in chief is making the rest of America more childlike, more immature, less impulse control. Because, you know, as you described, we've gone from, okay, he's new, he's learning, to, no, this is fine, we're okay with this. So, and that's the thing that you know, the president, whether, you know, for better or worse, is a role model. And so you do have people who are modeling their behavior. You see it in their language. You see it in their lack of impulse control. You see it in the way in which so many, well, you know, you spend time on Twitter just watching the number of toddlers on Twitter. And, you know, people who might have been grownups 5 years ago have regressed.
Right. And we've all had immature moments on Twitter. That's one of the dangerous things about Twitter. The difference is that most people, when they do that, immediately feel remorse, or, you know, there is a point at which we do act in a more mature way. But you're right. Can I read the last paragraph from the book? Because it basically echoes what you said.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is never going to grow up. Expecting him to mature is indulging in make-believe. It will be up to the American people and not the toddler in chief to set aside childish things. If voters reelect Trump in 2020, then he is no longer the most immature American. The American electorate would be just as developmentally delayed as the 45th president. The true toddlers in chief would be us.
Ooh, that is good. I've thought a lot about the election and the way it will change the way Americans look at one another if there are certain results. Daniel Dresner, that was a mic drop moment. So we might as well drop the mic here. The book is Toddler in Chief by Daniel Dresner. You can find it on Amazon, any of these other places. The Toddler in Chief, what Donald Trump teaches us about the modern presidency, and just out, came out this month, right?
Yeah, it came out, I believe the official release date was the 9th.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and being so generous with your time.
Oh, please. Thank you. It was a joy.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.